So tonight I'm going to talk about letting go of or working with identity constructions. Hopefully by the time that you leave here today, you'll understand what identity constructions are and be able to look at how they either limit you or support you, and then so that you can choose whether you want to let them go or not. Right? So what had me thinking about this is the other day we had a special event on compassionate communication. And I was asking the teacher a question about normal trends among genders that I noticed in doing that work. And one woman called out, "I'm sure that's only for heteronormative people." And I was like, huh, I wonder if it is. You know, there's always exception to every rule. We don't all fit into any particular categories, right? But then it had me thinking about and really feeling into what's the difference between our internal experience of who we are and our identities or these constructions. So Thomas Merton, you may have heard of him. He was the Trappist Catholic monk who taught contemplative Catholic practice. Here's a quote from Thomas Merton. He said, "We have the choice of two identities, the external mask, which seems to be real, and the hidden inner person who seems to us to be nothing, but who can give oneself eternally to the truth in which one subsists." So I talked about this a couple weeks ago, and I think I've talked about it before, but Rodney Smith, I did a month-long retreat with him, and he talked about, the whole retreat was about this, the fact that we live, human beings are of two realms, the relative realm and the absolute realm. And the relative realm is the one of form. Material world, of thought, of mental concepts, of time, right? So that's all in the relative realm. And the absolute realm is the one that you hear Jack Kornfield quoting a lot, the unborn, the undying, you know, Buddha's words, that timeless part of ourselves, the spacious, formless, non-conceptual realm, characterized by space and love. So it's not bound by the physical realm, right? And these are both realities of who we are. We are of the relative realm, we're of the absolute realm. We can get lost, so we don't want to be imbalanced, all in the absolute or all in the relative. And when we get imbalanced, then life doesn't feel too good or doesn't work very well. So we want to balance the relative and absolute realms. We want to access them both. But I believe our society is probably dominant in one over the other. Any guesses which one? The relative, the physical, the one of form and time. Right. So we're pretty imbalanced that way. But they're two halves of the same coin, and one is not superior to the other. They work together. We need them both. So in the relative realm, right, of mind and body, physical form, we need the mind and body to have this experience of the relative and the absolute, but especially of the relative realm. And in the relative realm, the mind is the creative organ that processes information and creates our reality. In every sense of the word, if you study neuroscience, the mind pretty much spits out its perceptions of what's happening. And so the mind is constantly creating, right? And some of its creations that it creates are positive and wonderful and help us navigate this world with more skill and equanimity. And some of its creations, like particular self-identities, can do either. They can both enhance our lives and support us, or they can really be detrimental to our well-being and our happiness, future happiness. So which one is it? And at which moment? Right? So a self-identity is a persona. It's a mental construct, a concept, a belief that we construct about ourselves, if it's a self-identity, right? And it's based on something that we think about or want to believe about ourselves. And it's a persona in that we want to make sure that, you know, it's not only how we present ourselves to the external world, right? But it's how we want other people to think of us. And it may or may not be consistent with our internal experience of who we are. Often it isn't. So many of our self-identities are created and hoisted upon us before we even realize it, before we even understand life at a young age by other people, our family, society, or group, right? Like gender identities. What are some gender identities? Male. Female. And now I believe, you know, they're starting to become less solid with gender identities, which I believe is people starting to let go of this rigidity around gender. I've heard of gender fluid and gender neutral, right? What are some class identities that are hoisted upon us? Top 10%? Anyone here top 10%? Invite them to our sangha. That was a joke, by the way. What else? Class identities. Poorly educated,
white trash,
highly educated, right, middle class,
blue collar,
right, we could go on and on, heritage identities, I considered myself Arab American for a long time. Who else, what are some heritages?
Yankee,
especially down here, you hear that.
Southerners.
African American.
Jewish Christian,
that's a religious identity, right? We have all kinds of religious identities. We have sexual identities. Heterosexual, bisexual.
Buddhist.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Transsexual, gay. Lifestyle identities are coming in and becoming more important now. Can anybody think of any lifestyle identities?
Urban and rural?
Yeah. Urban and rural.
Rural.
But there's like polyamorous. Isn't that a kind of a lifestyle identity? Polyamory. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. And it keeps changing, right? But I believe that a lot of these identities are becoming more fluid, are becoming more honest and not so tight and rigid, and people are starting to become open to a lot of different types of identities. At least I hope so. Right? But group identification helps us because that we get the acceptance and the protection from our group. And in a way, it's how we evolved, and it's been really important in the human evolution. But it can also harm us to be part of a group identity, because, and we can talk about this more, but do we want to try to say anything that might be in opposition to the main beliefs of the group? Right? So it might hinder independent thinking. We're going out of the box or being more open to other concepts or ideas or acting differently from the people in our primary groups. And we might pretend to be inauthentic just to satisfy the people in our group. right? The other thing, too, is when we belong to or identify with a group, well, with any identity, it opens the door, but especially in a group, to seeing other groups as separate and different from our group. So we see how other groups are different, and we other people, and we separate ourselves from them. We judge, and this opens the door for us to judge others and condemn others. As soon as we separate ourselves into a separate group, we automatically tend to judge the others as either superior or inferior or weird or something, right? And this condemnation and judgment is the very beginning of what allows us to be cruel to one another. It's the beginning of wars and arguments and breakdowns in relationships and groups. And this is how we can really abuse one another. Here's Butch Hancock. He says, "Life in Lubbock, Texas taught me two things. One is that God loves you and you're going to burn in hell. The other is that sex is the most awful, filthy thing on earth and you should save it for someone you love." How is my Texas accent? If you're from Texas, I apologize. But many of our identities are not thrust upon us by others. They're thrust upon us by ourselves. We've taken on a lot of identities in our life. So whether inherited or self-created, our practice asks you to use mindfulness, to use inquiry to explore these self-identities, to really pick them apart, see them clearly, to know that they're there. Here's teacher Philip Moffat. He says, "Identity differentiation, learning what is not self, is fundamental in spiritual development, and it is one of the most difficult and confusing aspects of spiritual practice." Identity differentiation, seeing what is not self. So I'm going to say that it starts by identifying the facts versus the identity constructions. Only the facts, sir or ma'am. So I'm going to give you a few examples about myself. Fact, I have consistently exercised and had success athletically when I was younger. Identity construction, I am a good athlete. You see the difference? Okay. Fact, I usually naturally care about people, and I like to do nice things for people I care about. Fact, that's a fact. That's been consistently behavior. Identity creation, I am a good and generous person. You see the difference? So on one hand, identity creations can be helpful. They can help motivate us to act in certain ways that are helpful. For instance, because I saw myself as an athlete, it motivated me to work out most of my adult life. I've been a gym rat, which has probably helped me with my own health, right? Kept my body stronger. Maybe I've been avoiding osteoporosis because of it. Do I have guns? No? No, I got to work out more. On the other hand, these identity constructions can, especially if we get attached to them, they can cause suffering. They can cause a lot of suffering. For instance, if I was really attached to my identity of myself as a good athlete, which I've let go of, by the way, this would cause me stress and suffering if I got injured and couldn't work out in the gym, right? For the time that I wasn't able to work out. Or what if I decide to do something athletically and then I didn't perform well? Right? Or what about if I start getting older and I can't lift the same amount of weights that I used to when I was in my 20s? Or what if I get even older and then just can't do any of that anymore? Right? If I see myself as an athlete, am I going to suffer? a lot more than if I didn't see myself as an athlete, right? One identity that really helped me that I realized I had was I saw myself as a meditator. So, you know, people would ask me, I say, yeah, I'm a meditator, and I really had this identity. So every day I got my hour of meditation in without question. I didn't even think about it. I just did it automatically because I was a meditator, right? But in fact, I was shocked to find out that other people had a hard time maintaining a regular daily practice. I just assumed everybody else did the same thing. Lo and behold, that's not necessarily true. But then if I didn't get a chance to sit that day because something was going on, then I would feel guilty or stressed out or, you know, want to make really sure that I got it in the next day. Right. So as my practice evolved, I realized I was attached to my identity of myself as a meditator. And I had to loosen my grip on this belief, this identity as the one who meditates, and just practice without being the meditator. So I'm kind of hinting in the direction I'm going in. Because mindfulness and the mindfulness arena, the Buddhist practice, we're constantly bringing our awareness to our beliefs. To look at our beliefs, look at our attitudes, look at how we're interacting with the world, right? With ourselves and the world. What am I bringing to the table? Anytime I suffer, what am I attached to that I probably could loosen my grip on, right? So we don't want to get detached. We're gonna have these self-identities cropping up, but we want to hold them lightly, not be necessarily attached to them. So this insight arises when you're clinging to identity. When you start to see clinging to identity, you start to see how it makes you suffer, the arenas in which this identity makes you suffer. And then you also see that you create a really solid, strong, rigid sense of self. It limits us, you know, to the meditator or the athlete. Am I open to a lot of different other possibilities if I'm rigidly attached to some identity? Not necessarily, right? And that this rigidity, this creating this identity, creates that separation, not only from my own self, my own inner experience, but it creates a separation from other people as well. And according to what the Buddha said, this creating a separate self is the source, is the root of all suffering. Right? Craving, clinging to a separate sense of self is the root of all stress. So I don't think it's realistic to expect ourselves to not form any identities, that this could turn into a state of delusion and la-la landness, right? But we want to see our identities and hold them lightly, right? Can they become more fluid? Let some of them go, but have other ones be more fluid. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow as a man, most likely, right? I'm going to wake up as a female, probably. But can I hold that lightly? Can I hold all my beliefs around what does it mean to be a female? Well, I don't necessarily know, right? Can I be open to that? Let it change, let it evolve, let it show itself to me each moment. So the problem comes when our inner reality of ourselves, our inner experience of who we are at the core, doesn't match up to our identity. Right? And it's not going to always match up to our identity. Because identity is created. It's a concept. It's a construction. It's not who we are. Another problem is when someone else accuses us or doesn't or sees us differently from this identity that we're so rigidly attached to, right? Or judges us based on their beliefs about those identities of different groups or different people. That's when the suffering comes in. I realized I was somewhat attached to being a Buddhist teacher. I didn't realize this at first, and then, you know, I've been studying for 30 some years, practicing for 30 some years, gone on probably years worth of meditation retreats, minimum of a month every year for many years. Anyhow, so study with a Buddhist monk for a week, for several hours each week, and study. No. Practice. And then some lady came up to me and teach for over a decade. A lady came up to me and she said, can you help me find a good Buddhist teacher? And I was like, I had this inner contraction of, oh, like someone stabbed me in the heart. I wanted to say, what am I, chopped liver? And I was like, whoa, there's some attachment here, Rania, what's going on? So I realized right then that I had some attachment to an identity as seeing myself as a good Buddhist teacher. I was like, oh, maybe I need to loosen my grip on this. So the question is, what identities have you formed? Really, looking at them? How do they hinder or support you? Can you still save the behavior that supports you without being attached to the identity? Right? And can you see the identity as the mind's construction? What benefits are you getting from holding on to and clinging to this identity as well? So the Buddha taught that the phenomenon of identity, in fact, the phenomena of all experiences created by moment clinging to the five aggregates, five particular factors that make up our experience. And whether you know this or not, some people just, I remember when I first heard teachers talk about the aggregates, I heard, wah, 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 wah. Like, whatever. But anyhow, some people really like it. I do now, by the way. But here are the five aggregates. The combination of these five aggregates make up each and every moment of our experience. Clinging to them causes us suffering. So there's bodily sensations, the material realm is one aggregate. Feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is the second aggregate. Perceptions of whatever is happening in this experience based on all of our accumulated knowledge of the path from the past is the third one. Mental formations, thoughts, anything that stimulates our conceptual world. And then the fifth one is consciousness, hearing consciousness, seeing consciousness, tasting consciousness, touching consciousness. Did I get all of them? Smelling? Did I get smelling? Anyhow, so consciousness is the fifth one. So it's the identifying with these aggregates, clinging to them, that causes us this feeling of wanting our experience to continue. We really like it, and then we cling to it, and we crave it. And, you know, I think it's really important to look at and to have compassion for ourselves. Why did we create these identities to begin with? Right? Probably because we didn't feel safe in the world. Maybe we didn't feel accepted, or we wanted really desperately to be accepted in our group. We wanted to be liked, seen as worthy of being part of our group, right? So for some reason, we got the message that we weren't enough. Our inner experience of who we are wasn't enough, that we had to present some addition, some concept of who we are into the world. And then we try to, whenever we create these identities, then we have to support the identity, and we have to project the identity, and we have to make sure everybody knows who this identity is, and then we have to defend it when anybody says anything different. Do you see all the suffering here? But yet having compassion for ourselves, because we're in a world that teaches us we're not enough. Every time we turn around, there's some message that we're not enough from our major society. So our true identity, our experience of who we are, is not a solid, fixed thing. It's fluid. It's ever-changing. It's dynamic. It's connected. It's energetic. Right? So when we learn to start letting go of these constructs and these concepts and identity attachments to these self-identities, then we can learn to roll with our inner experience. We can learn to trust the unfolding of our inner experience. We can have the faith and trust to allow this, whatever this personality is, to express itself in its own unique way. And in that way, we end up being a gift. You end up being a gift to the world instead of this nervous, anxious projection machine that feels insecure because we can never live up to our identity constructs. So then we can stop making up the stories, too, of who we think other people want us to be. And we quit taking ourselves so seriously, right? It kind of weakens the ego. We don't have to defend this egoic construct. We don't have to. It's really freeing. It's relaxing. And so we can just be who we came here to be. Does that make sense? Yeah, but it takes a lot of courage to let go of these identities and give ourselves permission to let this expression be in the world in ways that feel safe. Let yourself out of the bag, so to speak. Anyhow, and when we start to do this, we're tapping into the absolute realm. Because the relative realm is that of egoic mental constructs. The absolute realm is one of beingness, of experiencing, of spaciousness, of unfolding. So hold your identities lightly, your self-identities lightly, and please give yourself permission to allow your inner experience. Did you have a? Can you wait till I'm done, and then we'll explore. Thank you. And I'm not saying it's easy. But that's why we're practicing. This is under the walnut tree. When I face what has left my life, I bow. I walk outside into the cold rain nesting in my hair. All the houses near me have their lights on. Somewhere there is a deep listening. I stand in the dark for a long time under the walnut tree, unable to tell anyone, not even the night, what I know. I feel the darkness rush towards me, and I open my arms. That's by Lynn Martin. So thank you for your attention and your deep practice for being here tonight.